give for that wonderful phrase. To hear those three.
Patricia T. O'Connor is here to talk about the English language and take your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And until her most recent book, Three Little Words, made perfect sense, because she wrote three books, so either by herself or in collaboration. I hate to talk about somebody and say she as you're sitting there, but
right.
They all had three-word titles. The last one, four-word titles.
Well, you could discount the articles.
So it would be just, origin of specious instead
yeah, I mean,
of origin
just don't,
of the
don't count the as a word.
Okay.
Well, yeah, because I like that theme song
Woe
very
is
much.
I, you send me, uh-huh. words fail me. And origin of specious.
Yes.
But we know there's a the in it. And when you come by, you usually have something in your mind, things that you want to talk about.
I do. This is something that a listener brought up. But actually, I'm sure a lot of people have noticed this and wondered about it. Mayor Bloomberg is a very articulate and well-spoken man, but he does have one peculiarity in his speech. I can't help noticing it. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of examples on Google, and it happens almost every time he makes a speech. He seems to confuse his ways and his means. For example, just a little over a week ago, in speaking of the proposed sports arena in Brooklyn, he said, "We've got to find a ways. Bruce Ratner's got to find a ways to build this complex in Brooklyn." And in 2010, speaking of trying to save St. Vincent, he says, "It would be great if you could find a ways to do it."
But he adds S's to words all the time. A listener wrote in fact, to point out that he says anywheres and elsewheres.
Oh, yeah, elsewheres?
Yes.
Well, I have scores of examples of this, finding a ways. They should have found a ways. And I started looking into it, and I think what's happened is that he's conflating this use of ways to mean a method or a means with another usage of a ways, meaning a distance, which is rather colloquial or informal, but it actually is considered a standard English, as in, "I live a ways from Houston Street," or "he has a long ways to go in his mm-hmm. career," using ways in the plural to mean a distance, whether real or figurative.
And you think that's what he means?
Well,
ooh,
I think he's
the ways and means.
I think he's adopted that usage, which actually has a very legitimate heritage. It's been around, believe it or not, since at least 1588, using ways to mean a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I grew up a lot. I grew up hearing it a lot in the Midwest. It was very common, and
he's from
use
Boston,
it myself.
Isn't he?
I don't know. Is he
I
from
think
Boston?
He is.
Boston and New York aren't all that different in their speech patterns, believe it or not. The accent is a little different, but they use a lot of the same speech patterns. But I think that's probably what has happened, and I won't say I think he ought to correct that, because it adds a little charm, I think, to have a little some sort of form of distinction in your speech, even if it's not 100% kosher. But I didn't know he said elsewheres. That's very interesting.
A lot. Well, which is something I hear other people also say.
Anyways.
Although, yeah.
Uh-huh. Anywheres. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mayor Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Another listener writes in about the misuse of the word alternate, where the speaker means another option or choice in which the correct word is alternative. Or is that true? Are you hearing
well, that's true if you want to be a real stickler. But I think that these days alternate is allowed to be used as a noun for an alternative choice. Let me just check here see what American Heritage says. I wouldn't be surprised if they allow it now. Nine times out of 10, you look up these things, you're sure that they're misuses, and then you find, okay, here's alternate verb, a transitive verb, an adjective, da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes, noun meaning an alternative. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Another listener, Gabriel in New York, says it seems like it's become a trend to pronounce the first R in February. Mm-hmm. Is this correct? Actually, I didn't know it was a trend. I thought it was the way we used to say it.
You say it perfectly. But the truth is there have been studies of this done that show that most people do not pronounce the first R. Most people say February.
Well, but a lot of people say nuclear, too. Does that make it
not
correct?
Most people. Well, actually, that sounds like a rhetorical question, Leonard, but actually it's very legitimate. In fact, eventually that does make it correct. That's how pronunciations evolve. When the critical mass reaches a certain point, they become accepted as the way to say something.
Was there ever a time when people said Wednesday?
No. Not that I know of.
So it's always been Wednesday, as though the N preceded the D.
Yes. Now, there was a time when at least there was an attempt to say the D and the K together in handkerchief that fell out very quickly because in English, we don't like to put consonants together unless it's TR or ST. There are certain patterns, we can accommodate, but we don't accommodate one like handkerchief. Or often.
Mm-hmm. Although people do
say
often.
Some do say often. Mm-hmm. Correct. You say schism instead of schism, I know.
No, I say schism.
You say schism. Oh, that's right.
I do.
You do. You always pronounce things exquisitely correctly, but...
Exquisitely correctly.
Excuse me.
No, I'm just being obnoxious.
I know. You can't help it.
Anything else before we go to some calls?
Well,
first of all, let me, because it's time to tell people what they're listening to. This is the Leonard Lopez Show on WNYC, and that's AM and FM and WNYC.org. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, who's written a number of books on the English language. A listener has called me on saying any number of books, although I'm not sure that's wrong, but I will try to stop saying it.
I don't see that there's any difference between saying a number and any number.
Well, it bothers people.
Yeah?
So many things bother people.
Yeah, I know. Keeps them awake nights.
I get so many emails and comments on our show page complaining about guests who say you know a lot or say a lot or mispronounce a word. Or recently a guest called me sir a number of times. He was – former CIA agent.
Oh, right.
And I wonder, first of all, why it bothers people so much and what they think I should do about it. Should I say to him, stop calling me sir? You're saying you know all the time. Stop doing that.
You could do it during the break.
No, I can't.
Or hold up a sign.
Would we do that to somebody we were having dinner with? You
know,
you're saying you know an awful lot. It's annoying me.
I used to say that a lot when I first came on the show. I don't know if you remember.
You said you know more?
Maybe 13, 14 years ago. I said it much more when I first started speaking publicly.
You've unlearned it?
I've unlearned it. It took some doing. And one still slips in once in a while.
I see nothing wrong with saying it.
It's a tick.
Yeah. It's a way of getting us from here to there.
It's present in practically all languages that you know.
N'est-ce pas?
Je sais. Mm-hmm. Right.
Whatever.
Right.
It's because,
also, no problem. That's in all languages, too.
Even though it seems to bother listeners an awful lot.
Yes.
Let's take some calls. Our number again is 646-829-3985. And Martin from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Martin. Go.
Hi. I want to ask this question. This was a sentence, and I wonder if Ms. O'Connor could tell us whether apostrophe S is correct in this. It says, the more upfront...
Well, we've suddenly lost you, Martin. Try it again.
It says, the more Updike's characters misbehave, the more they proclaim, etc. The question is, should there be an apostrophe S in characters in the sentence, the more Updike's characters misbehave?
No, there should be no apostrophe there.
Yeah, Updike's, apostrophe S, possessive. Yeah. Updike's characters?
Yeah, but there's no apostrophe in the word characters, only in...
Oh, no, not in characters.
Yeah.
Not in characters. Thank you very much. That's what I was in.
Where did you get that?
This was from a book called The Critics Buried Away by Frederick Cruz, who is a literary critic.
I suspect that was just some editor's mistake. Mm-hmm. There are typos, and they don't always get caught.
Right.
I recently saw one in the New York Times. They were talking about Amare Stoudemire, the great Knicks player, who gave credit to his teammates. He says, they're... very important in my success.
Mm-hmm.
And in the New York Times, the there was spelled T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. So I dropped them a little note asking them if they were inspired by the fact that Amari has an apostrophe in his name, A-M-A-R apostrophe E. So they just want to put apostrophes in anything that he says. But I was amazed that the Times would let something like that slip by.
Well, newspapers can't always give everything as close a look as they'd like to.
Yeah, well, and we have to
understand
that.
They're under a lot of pressure.
They are? Is that it?
Yes.
Because
yes.
Of the cutbacks and everything?
Well, yes.
You used to be at the Times.
I know.
Would you have allowed
everything
that to happen?
Everything was perfect back then.
June from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. You know, I'm confused about what you just said, Lenny. Did you say that he said they're very important to my success? And
No. Their input, their contribution
okay,
is very important.
Okay, because there should be an apostrophe if it's they are very important. Anyway, not to correct the host.
No, you can. Please.
Okay, I have a couple of expressions I'm very curious about. Two of them mean exactly the same thing as each other. One is spill the beans, and the other one is let the cat out of the bag. Mm-hmm. And the other one is calling the shots, which is different. But can you tell me the origins of any of those?
Well, I think calling the shots comes from billiards.
Oh, it does? Okay.
Let the cat out of the bag. My husband and I did a blog item about that one recently.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, I can't remember what the answer was.
But wouldn't it be that the cat inside the bag would be creating a lot of tumult, and you want, and so you just want the whole thing to be made clear?
Well, I think it's having a secret.
Yeah,
it's a quiet secret. It's not
it's
making
a tumult.
It's
revealing a secret. So
yeah,
must have been some situation in which you didn't know what was in the bag, and when you opened it up, you let the cat out of the bag, and now you knew what was in there or something, but you don't know what it is.
I can't remember. If you go to my blog, you'll find out.
Okay.
Also, spill the beans.
Yeah.
That one I can't remember.
Oh.
Many times I look these things up, and afterwards they slip my mind. That's one of the hazards of getting old.
Right. You're not old.
I do all this work, and then I forget it.
Oh.
But I know I did the cat out of the bag, letting the cat out of the bag, and it escapes me.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thanks.
Let's take some more questions that listeners have written in. Amy writes, so often I hear people using the present for the future, as in, mm-hmm. Where are you today? Today I'm home all day.
Yes. Now, it's rather... a distortion of English grammar to think that we have a lot of tenses. We really just have past and present. A lot of people think that, in fact, we have no future, that we only use will as an auxiliary.
I think only tea partiers think we have no future.
But at any rate, we often use a form of the present to talk about the future. I am going to the museum tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Rather than I will be going.
Rather than
museum.
I will be going. Or
which feels a little stilted, doesn't it? I'm
going
to the museum
tomorrow.
Or I
tomorrow. Will go. Right. You don't often say, I will go to the museum tomorrow. If you're just chatting with someone, you say, mm-hmm. I'm going to the museum tomorrow. So we use past and present tenses in a lot of different expanded ways in order to talk about other time periods. And that's an example. I hope that answers your question. Is that what you were asking?
I think that was something that was written in. Another listener wants to know about the pronunciation of what I say is Carnegie Hall.
Oh, yes. Andrew Carnegie was Scottish, and in Scotland, his name would be pronounced Carnegie. And it was pronounced Carnegie a lot when he was alive. Over time, it got more or less Americanized into Carnegie. But you'll still find a lot of, like Carnegie Mellon. It's always pronounced Carnegie. But you still will find people who say Carnegie.
Me.
You say Carnegie?
Yes.
Right. That's the original Scottish pronunciation.
I don't know why. Because I say schism.
Something to do with schism.
A listener says, someone told me you should say, I feel badly, not I feel bad. Is that true?
No. You feel bad. You don't feel badly unless you're not very good at feeling. So feel bad and feel good are perfectly normal. Not only legitimate, but they are the correct constructions.
Kate in Brooklyn, my 10-year-old son uses the word amped as in, I'm 10 years old. Amped I?
Oh, that's interesting because there was an old contraction, amant, am not, amped I. And it's no longer used, except it may be
by her 10-year-old.
Yeah, but isn't it interesting that a kid would use that? Because it's a logical contraction. We say don't for do not. He says amant for am not. So actually, he's being very creative with his language there.
And very old English.
Yes, yes.
We'll take a little break and come back with more of your calls and comments to Patricia T. O'Connor. We're talking about the English language.
Oh, baby, what I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase.
Words. Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase to hear those three little words. That's all.
We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, who visits us once a month to talk about the English language, and we take your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Or if you want to ask Pat a question through the email, you can email her directly at mailbox@grammarphobia.com. And you can also click on Pat's blog at grammarphobia.com to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. I have a question. Do we know where that thing where they use a whole bunch of different wing dings or whatever they're called to denote obscenity comes from?
Oh,
like in cartoons?
In comic books and cartoons? Yes, you'll see a string of like an ampersand, an asterisk, a dollar sign, a hash mark, a couple more asterisks, and it'll mean the character is swearing. That's a good question. Those characters or those words are called Grawlixes. It's spelled G-R-A-W-L-I-X, Grawlix. And it was named by a cartoonist named Mort Walker 40-some years ago. And the lexicographer Ben Zimmer, whom I believe you've had Ben on your show before, he has a word for those two, obscenicon.
Mm-hmm.
So there are actually two words. You can choose between them. One is a Grawlix and one is an obscenicon.
Corey, one of my producers, says that cat out of the bag is a British naval term. The cat was a cat of nine tails, and the bag was a base bag that it was stored in.
I think that's a myth. Uh-huh. Sorry, Corey. I don't think that's true. There's another myth about the cat of nine tails that the expression no room to swing a cat came from the use of the cat of nine tails, but actually no room to swing a cat as a term in language was around long before the term cat of nine tails. I think that's another myth. I don't think that's it.
Okay.
Sorry, I wish I could remember the real one, but I know it doesn't have to do with cat of nine tails.
Let's take another call. Bob from West Long Branch, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Leonard. I would like to ask for Ms. O'Connor's take on the use of technologically obsolete expressions to express present actions. Like, what are you doing? I'm playing records when you're really playing music from your MP3 player. Or I'm right now sitting at my desk typing you a letter when you're entering information into your word processor.
And then you dial a call.
Yes, that's very interesting. You dial a call, even though phones don't have dials anymore. And actually, it's funny you should ask this, because Stuart and I were just talking about this yesterday.
Stuart is her husband.
My husband. And he noted that automobiles these days have a lot of, well, if you want to get fancy hubcaps, you can get them with spokes. So that they resemble the wheels of 150 years ago, which had spokes. But there are also...
But there's no real reason to have them.
No, there isn't. But a lot of times, bits of language from the old technology survives into the new technology.
And takes on the new meaning?
Yes, and takes on the new meaning. Now, this has happened quite a bit in the computers, of course, but also in ordinary talk. For instance... the dashboard of your car. You may think the word dashboard sounds a little odd. What is a dashboard? Why is it called a dashboard? The reason is that horse-drawn carriages had a board or an apron, leather apron, in the front, called a dashboard, to keep mud from splattering up on passengers from the horse's hooves. That was called a dashboard. And that survived into the automobile industry. Because the early cars... Basically, there was just a board between you and the engine. And
they were usually open.
Yes, open. And so that survived. But that's one reason why now we speak of acoustic guitars when we're talking about a guitar that's not electrified. There's a whole class of words like this that are sort of an anachronistic survivors of an earlier age.
But acceptable in current usage.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Well, when I have guests on who have just put out a new CD and they say our latest record.
All the time they do it.
Right.
That's part of the language,
right,
isn't
in
it?
Fact, I have a CD at home. It's a CD by Jane Monheit, a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And the CD itself looks like it's made to look like a record. It's black with a label in the middle, a round red label with the writing on it, just like a record. And it even has drawn on it little shiny marks, as if you were seeing a record from the side and you were getting the glints of the light reflecting off it. And I thought it was kind of clever.
A couple of listeners have written in about the way words are pronounced. And Josh from Brooklyn, for example, says he has a professor who pronounces the word adequate like this, adequate.
Adequate.
Another person wants to know why Brett Favre pronounces his name Favre when it should be Favre.
Right.
Well, because that's the way he pronounces his name.
Right, and his whole family has pronounced it that way. And interestingly, I answered a question about Brett Favre's name once from a listener. And I got hold of the Library of Congress's recording department, because they have people there who record books on tape, and they have to know how to pronounce names. In fact, I've had a couple of our books recorded, and they've emailed me to ask for pronunciations. But they have a little thing in there about Brett Favre, and they say it may be pronounced V-R-E, but... He pronounces it as if it was R-V-E, and we always take the pronunciation used by the person, not by how it's spelled.
I've discovered from many guests that they have just simplified the pronunciations of their names because it's hard for people to pronounce
them.
Right, There was a football player whose name would have been pronounced Taliaferro, but he called himself Tolliver.
Oh.
And I'm sure it was because he came from the Midwest and people had a hard time with that name.
Now, you could pronounce your name Lopate.
Well, probably was Lopata or Lopata
Leopoldo
in Russia.
Leonardo Lopato or Lopate. And so you could make yourself all exotic.
I think my grandfather, when people started pronouncing the name that had originally been in Cyrillic or whatever, when they started pronouncing it Lopate, he thought, okay, I'm in America. That's the way people are pronouncing it. And the name became Lopate.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the way a lot of names, it's harder to say Favre than it is Favre.
Oh, yeah. Favre is much easier.
Should we take some more calls? Oh,
yeah.
Well, first, this person, Boo, in Brooklyn wrote, I was raised in Mississippi and was taught to say no, sir, yes, ma'am, et cetera. I still do it because I feel that it's polite and it's just a natural way of my speech. I've lived in New York City for 11 years, and many people tell me that it is rude. People are offended.
Rude? Oh,
please
my
tell
goodness.
Me. Let me know what's the most polite way of addressing your elders, clients, et cetera.
That's news to me that it would be considered rude. Now, when you were interviewing that CIA person who called you sir, did you feel it was rude, or did you feel—
I didn't feel it was rude. I thought it was something that I wouldn't have done. I noticed it. But
it sounds faintly military.
And he came out of the military. So
right.
I took it as a sign of respect. Whether I deserve that respect or not is for somebody else to decide. But I see nothing wrong with saying yes or no, sir.
Once in a while I'm called ma'am. Someone says yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am. Well, it makes me feel old, especially if it's some young whippersnapper saying it, I think. What does he think I am, his grandmother?
Another listener, Laura from the Upper West Side, writes, XXX for obscenities dates back to Dutch New York. I heard a talk by an archivist from Albany, and I think it was in transcripts of legal proceedings first and then was taken up by the English.
Huh.
I didn't even know that they were making adult films in those days.
A little XXX for a kiss at the end of a letter. But, in Victorian fiction, often you will find just a D and a long dash if a character is saying damn, for instance. Or you'll just find a long dash all by itself to mean strong language. They wouldn't have even hinted at obscenities in those days. But there are different conventions for what cartoonists use their Grolixes for.
Benjamin from New York, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I wondered why it is that if the word whence means from where, you often see from whence.
Mm-hmm. It's a common error. I think it's an error, and I know when I was a copy editor, I always used to take out the from.
But I always thought it was a problem until I saw it in Shakespeare, and then I started questioning my own.
It's true. It's always a good idea to question your own opinions, because actually from whence is a fairly common usage, even though the from is already built in. So it's a bit redundant.
Okay. Thank you for calling us. And Ben from Clifton, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling about the expression, the bee's knees. I guess my stats professor used to use one, the cat's pajamas.
Uh-huh, and the cat's meow.
Yeah. I think this is a class of phrases that are just kind of humorous, nonsensical phrases. Bees probably don't have knees. Sort of like hen's teeth. And cat's pajamas, cats don't wear pajamas. It's just a little nonsensical, humorous construction that doesn't really have much of a meaning.
But Ben, you also say you come from Pittsburgh, and you want to tell us something?
I have relatives in Pittsburgh, and they are able to pronounce it. Apparently they are very proud of their Carnegie heritage, and they think that the New Yorkers are just plain wrong.
Yes, it's true. In Pittsburgh, they still say Carnegie, I think. They pronounce, they say Andrew Carnegie.
And they should know.
They also say Yinz. Am I right?
I think we had a problem with that call.
I hope he didn't crash. I think he was driving.
You're not sure about yinz?
No, I haven't heard that.
Okay.
Haven't heard yinz?
Huh? Hasn't heard yinz. Marcellus writes, the word record comes from the word recording. Nothing wrong with calling a CD or MP3 a record.
Right.
In the same way that we use the measurement horsepower.
That's another one, horsepower, that came up when Stuart and I were talking. That we still talk about cars in terms of horsepower, engines in terms of horsepower.
Grant in Harlem wonders, how did Pat, meaning you, unlearn saying you know?
By concentrating on it very hard. And it was difficult. And it took me a long time. It was more or less a speech impediment. I had to think of it in those terms. I had to stop and think each time before I spoke, which is difficult to do because on the radio you can't stop and think. You just have to speak. So I practiced a lot, and you'll notice now I'm saying And I think it's sort of self-conscious because I'm thinking about one speech problem and it brings on another.
But we all do that.
Yeah.
People had pointed out that I, coming from Williamsburg, said neighborhood. Well, I had to learn to say neighborhood. Also, I grew up on, for a long time, unfortunately, on Broadway in Williamsburg. But I say Broadway. I don't know why I say Broadway. And listeners have actually complained that Broadway.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, you know, there are very sensitive listeners out there. What can you do? Robert in New Jersey says, beg the question means to assume the truth of the very point raised in a question, as in a fallacy of a debate. So says dictionary.com. A lot of people in broadcasting misuse it to mean a situation demands that this question be raised.
Right.
So is that use of the phrase acceptable, he asks.
Well, let me say this about that. Almost nobody uses beg the question in the correct philosophical way that Aristotle used it and the way that you're referring to. For instance, if a mother whose son is under arrest says, my son cannot have committed that crime because he is not a criminal, she is begging the question because in her argument she's denying the argument.
Mm-hmm. We have people with the answers to the question count of the bag and all sorts of other things, but we don't have enough time. So if you...
Maybe I'll talk about it next week.
Well, why don't you write to Pat? You can email her directly at mailbox@gramophobia.com and write to her. Don't write to me. You can also click on Pat's blog at gramophobia.com to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. And if you don't want to do either of those things, well, you can always call us the next time that Pat is on our show, which will be March 23rd. Because Pat does visit us once a month. Mm-hmm. And if that's not enough, you can always go to the bookstore and buy one of her books. Have I left anything out?
I don't think so.
Thank you so much for being with us again today, Patricia T. O'Connor.
My pleasure.